Okay, let's continue where we left off yesterday. And we are now looking at the sutta called the Avita Sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya, 1062. And what this sutta is doing, just to recap very briefly, what we're looking at now is all the conditions that support avijja, avijja being delusion, being ignorance, being a distorted outlook, right? Seeing the world in the wrong way, and I was looking at all the conditions that support that distortion, that delusion about reality.
Yes.
And of course, once you understand the causality, the conditioning that lies behind that, you start to be able to do something about it. And this is what this is really all about. So very interesting for that reason, at least in my opinion, so hopefully I can get you interested as well, because all of these things are kind of tied together very nicely. So the first thing that we saw yesterday was that craving for existence has a nutriment, and the nutriment for craving for existence is precisely this delusion that we were talking about. When you are deluded, you want to exist, because you think existence is great, it's fun, I've got to kind of enjoy life, enjoy all these things, and you think it's really worthwhile. And of course the reversal of that, which is kind of, this is really where it gets quite challenging, and that is when you see things according to reality, suddenly existence doesn't really become so worthwhile anymore. And this is where the Buddhist teachings become really challenging. And there was somebody yesterday who said that they felt a little bit out of their depth when they came to these teachings. They listened to Ajahn Brahm on the internet, but didn't really know much about the suttas. And some of these things are very deep, so just take them on board, just listen to them. You don't have to say, yay or nay, or yes, I assent, or I believe, or I have faith, anything like that. This is Buddhism. It's more about inquiring and investigating and thinking about these things than kind of taking them on board as a kind of a dogma or anything like that. So just take them on board, just gradually think about it, evaluate it, and as we go through this, hopefully you will get more broader understanding of what's happening here. So, then, of course, the next question is, what is the nutriment for a delusion, for avijja? And what it says here, it should be said, the five hindrances. The five hindrances are the nutriment for delusion. And that is, of course, very interesting, because many of the things that we do on the Buddhist path is to reduce the five hindrances. So every time you reduce the five hindrances, you are in effect reducing delusion. You are reducing your distorted outlook on reality. You're seeing things more clearly. You have more vipassana. This word vipassana is very interesting. And to me, vipassana really means clear seeing. That's what it means. You see things clearly. Less distortion in your outlook. It is often translated as insight, I think it's kind of okay, but I think clear seeing is actually more accurate, because vipassana is something that develops gradually, and you have large varieties of vipassana, whereas insight is more like a flash or bang of wisdom, you see things properly. But vipassana is much more a graduated thing, that's how it is used in the suttas as far as I can see. And so clear seeing, of course, is much more graduated than insight, which often is a flash of inspiration, or a flash of wisdom, if you like. So as we reduce the five hindrances, this vipassana is gradually increasing, the delusion is decreasing as a consequence. And why? Why is that the case? What is actually going on here? And what is going on is not very hard to understand this for yourself from your own personal experience. And that is often when you have, when you have strong defilements in the mind, is actually very clear if you think about it, especially if you think about it afterwards, that you are in a deluded state at that time. If you get really upset about something, you get really angry. And what are the actions that you do when you are angry? Sometimes there are actions that you regret afterwards. Afterwards, like, wow, why did I say that? What a silly thing to say. I shouldn't have said that. And then you compare the feeling you have afterwards, you compare that to the feeling you had when you did that act, and you understand that actually you were deluded at the time. ill will, the upset or whatever it was, it drives you. And it's this very compelling force in the mind that drives you to act. It drives you to act even though that action actually isn't really very purposeful or very useful. It kind of makes you do stuff which you really shouldn't be doing. And you are under the kind of the sway of delusion at that particular time. So it's very clear when you look at the before and the after, and you compare that, and you can see what anger and ill will and upset does to your mind. It actually has this very distorting power in the mind. And it's exactly the same thing with desire. Sometimes you desire something very strongly, and you go out and you think you have to buy something. Something looks really nice, You think, oh, I've got to buy that. And you buy it, and you bring it back home, and it kind of sits there on the shelf for the next 5 years or whatever. You never use it, right? It's something that actually, at the time, the desire said, you need this, you must have it. The advertisements were getting to you or something like that. That's what advertising is all about, right? Making you think that you need something that you don't actually need. And it works. This is the problem. It actually really works really well. That's why companies spend billions on advertising, always going. We're all a bunch of fools are buying into this stuff. This is the problem, because we are deluded. We don't see things clearly. The desire gets the better of us. And that is a small thing. One of the really big problems, of course, is when it comes to relationship with other people. We already have a good relationship with somebody. And then we go and have a relationship with somebody else. And then we destroy, perhaps, the original relationship that was so good. But at the time, it seems right. I had to do that. It is so important. It is the desire, the craving, the delusion at the time is so strong that it makes you do things that in the long run are against your own best interest. And this is what it really means by delusion here. So as we reduce these defilements in the mind, especially ill will and desire, we start to see things more clearly. Of course, these defilements that come in a large number of varieties and refinements. There are some defilements that are very obvious. You really know if you're really angry. It's very obvious, right? You're kind of always very, very clear that you're angry with somebody. But then, of course, these defilements come in very refined varieties, very kind of small, tiny little desires, or tiny little upset about various things. Or just a little bit of tiredness in the mind, or a little bit of restlessness in the mind. And these things are very, very, very refined. As those defilements go down, so you have these very refined defilements, you have to abandon them absolutely for the mind to see 100%. So even a little bit of defilement in the mind is going to be a source for delusion and lack of understanding. So this is why, as we reduce those hindrances more and more and more, ultimately abandon them completely, that is where the mind has the possibility of seeing things according to reality. Only when those hindrances are completely gone can you see things in the right way. This is why so much of the Buddhist path is about the purification of the mind. Starting off with just the ordinary sila, the ordinary body and speech, then working with the mind to overcome the coarse defilements, and using a meditation subject like the breath or satipatthana or whatever it is to get away even the last remnant of defilements. Because that is where insight then becomes possible. That is where delusion doesn't have the nutriment anymore. The nutriment for delusion has disappeared. So delusion becomes weak. And that is where real insight becomes possible. So the reason why you don't kind of have insight straight away, just because delusion has disappeared, the reason is because your view at the outset is wrong. Because the view at the outset is wrong, it means that even when the hindrances are gone, you still have a misapprehension of what is going on. And that is where the insight comes. But the point is that the delusion is very weakened at that point. It doesn't have any support anymore. And because it doesn't have the support, it means that it is possible to make the breakthrough at that point. This is also one of the reasons why on the Buddhist path, right, we always start off with the right view. The Noble Eightfold Path begins the right view. That when you come to the last part of the Buddhist path, which is Samma Samadhi, and the reason why Samma Samadhi is so powerful, again, is because the hindrances are abandoned at that point. Exactly what we're seeing here. But the Samma Samadhi is conjoined. It comes together with right view from the beginning. And that is why it gives you the opportunity to make that breakthrough and see things in the right way. If you start off with the wrong view, then even if you get Samma Samadhi, you're not going to make the breakthrough because you're starting off with a misapprehension of things. So if you think there is a soul, right, or whatever, there is a God, and then when you come to Samma Samadhi, you say, yeah, confirm, there is a God, now I know, because I've seen it for myself. And this is the problem when you start off with the wrong ideas about things. So this is the five hindrances and how they support delusion. This is why so much of the Buddhist path is about reducing the five hindrances and eventually eliminating them completely. Everything is really kind of around, it's kind of about that in one way or another. And then it goes back more, right? We're going to take this backwards, step by step, all the way to the very beginning, where it all starts out. So what then is the nutriment for the five hindrances? And it says here the three kinds of misconduct. Yeah, this is a duccharita in the Pali language. And it literally means three kinds of, that's what it means, three kinds of misconduct, three kinds of bad behavior or wrong conduct, if you like. And of course, those three are misconduct by body, speech, and mind. That's what it refers to. So when you start practicing the precepts, when you start living a life of kindness and gentleness and speaking in the right way, acting in the right way, you are already undermining the defilements of the mind. You're already undermining the five hindrances. Yeah, just by doing that much. Just by, you know, being kind, being compassionate, being caring in the world, already you are undermining the five hindrances. Why is that? Well, because when you act with kindness, you're actually influencing your outlook as well. You're influencing the state of your mind. When you're kind, the only way you can really be kind to others is by seeing it as worthwhile. You've got to see the goodness in other people. You've got to be able to kind of almost forcing yourself to see the goodness in other people. So you're reducing the negative qualities in the mind at the same time. So just by consistently being kind by body and speech, you're actually purifying the mind already. Yeah, and that shows you the importance of this. So what that means really is that that the more you are able to have that, talking about it yesterday, the mindfulness, which always reminds you of the importance, the incredible importance of doing the right thing and avoiding the bad things. If you keep that in mind at all times, moment to moment, day to day, week in, week out, year after year, sometimes lifetime after lifetime, unfortunately, but we try to do as much as we possibly can in this lifetime. So you do this, you keep on doing it, and as you do that, consistently, you're actually purifying yourself in a very deep sense. And every time you make a mistake, right, every time you make a mistake, it's like you're taking two steps back on the path. And then you kind of, okay, that doesn't mean you become depressed about it and kind of upset about it or anything like that. But what it means is that you understand the significance of this and how powerful it is in purifying yourself and taking you forward. You can see how crucial it is here. It is so, the three kinds of misconduct, you're getting very close to the end of the path here. We're talking about the five hindrances and then delusion. That's only two steps away, in a sense. So if we can do that, it becomes an incredibly powerful support for everything on the Buddhist path. And then, of course, it is the mental purification itself. And this is a very important aspect of this. I'm going to talk about this a lot later on, because this is really worthwhile, putting in effort to purify the mind directly. Not just by keeping the precepts, but actually by directly working on the mind itself, on our perceptions, on our thoughts, on our outlook, on our views, all of these kinds of things. And it's not as difficult as you may think. It may sound hard to change our minds, but actually it is not that hard. All it takes really is commitment and perseverance. Some of the wisdom of the Buddha, you mix it nicely together, and out comes a more purified mind. That is kind of the idea there. What then is the nutriment for the three kinds of misconduct? And it says here, the non-restraint of the sense faculties. Yeah, non-restraint of the sense faculties is another very important aspect of the Buddhist teaching, the restraint of the sense faculties. And I'm talking about this at length again because it's very much related to how to purify the mind. So this is a very important part of this. And it's important to understand what this is about. And the idea here is to avoid a mind that is always kind of jumping around, kind of getting upset about something, then getting attached to something here. And always kind of yo-yoing around, right, from daily life, yo-yoing around, you like something, you dislike something, and you lack that evenness. And that evenness is kind of required for mindfulness to be established. Yeah, if the mind is always kind of jumping around everywhere, basically it means that you are being pulled around by the things of the world, and mindfulness doesn't have a chance to really be stable and to be clear about things. So we avoid that, and that is what sense restraint is all about. Avoiding being attracted and repelled by the things of the world. So we have to be very careful here, though, because in English, the word restraint usually implies force. Yeah, you restrain somebody. Police comes and restrain you so you can't kind of, you know, beat somebody up or something like that. Yeah, that's restraining, it's using force. You take out a restraining order against somebody. It means that they can't come within a certain distance of you, yeah. As soon as you kind of move within a certain circle, a certain radius of you, the police come and kind of pull them back. Yeah, it's a restraint. So, and this is the problem sometimes with translations, is that we have to be very careful that we actually understand what the concept behind these things mean, rather than attaching too much meaning to the English translation. If you attach too much meaning to the English translation, you think that force is what we should be using, because that's what restraint is all about. Yeah, but actually, it is a misunderstanding. It doesn't really mean force at all. And this is one of the things I want to point out as we go along here. But the main point for now is just to remember that what this is about is having that evenness of the mind. Only when you have that evenness of the mind are you able to fulfill the three kinds of good conduct. So that's why you have this connection here between lack of sense restraint and three kinds of bad conduct. Okay, so what is the cause, what is the nutriment for the lack of sense restraint or the non-restraint of the sense faculties? And it says here, mindfulness and clear comprehension. Yeah, so... The idea here, of course, is basically that you have to have a degree of mindfulness to be able to know what is going on with your senses. If you have no mindfulness, you are precisely going to be pulled around by all the things in the world. Either you're going to have aversion to them, or you're going to like them, all this kind of stuff. But when you have the sati, mindfulness is there. It means you have an ability to regulate yourself. And one of the beautiful things about sati, the sati is called the sat indriya, one of the five faculties. Why is it called a faculty? Faculty means something which gives you a degree of power, right? Enables you to do things. That's the idea of a faculty. A faculty is like an ability. So it gives you the ability, once you have sat indriya, it gives you a sense of power over yourself and over your life. You are in charge. Instead of all the things in the world being in charge of you, pulling you this way, pulling you that way, when you have the sat indriya, you feel that you are in charge. You can decide what you want to focus on. You can decide whether you want to allow a certain defilement to arise or not. Yeah. And this is it feels very empowering. Yeah, when you feel that you are in charge of your mind, you are in charge of how you're going to react to things, it's very empowering. Instead of feeling that you are a pawn, you are like a robot, you are like this puppet with strings, right, being kind of, you know, so there's a master kind of controlling you, lift your arm, lift your legs, whatever. Instead, you decide when you're going to lift that leg, you decide when you're going to lift that arm, not some other entity outside of you, which is all the conditioned phenomena outside. So this is the idea of sati, that's why it's called a faculty, because it enables you, empowers you, and makes you feel that you are in charge of your life. And that's actually a very nice way of thinking about sati, because otherwise it seems sort of empty. Yeah, I have sati, so what? Big deal, okay, I know what's going on. But actually, it is very empowering as well. And then we have the idea here of clear comprehension. And clear comprehension is another very important term in Pali language. It's sampajanyaha. Yeah, that's what it means. Sometimes translated as full awareness, which also is perfectly acceptable. And the idea of sampajanya is just to understand that you have the sati, you have the mindfulness of what is going on. And sampajanya is what tells you whether what is going on is suitable or not. Yeah, is it purposeful or not? The Pali commentaries, they give four qualities of sampajanya. One is purposefulness, one is suitability, and there's two more qualities that are much more profound. I'm not even going to mention those, not in this context anyway. But that is the most important part of that. So you know whether what is happening is suitable and purposeful. So what is the purpose? Well, if you're practicing the Buddhist path, the purpose is to move forward on the path. Yeah. So what you're doing now, is it helpful for moving you forward on the Buddhist path? Suitability, purposefulness. This is the kind of thing that this really is all about. And in a big picture of things, one of the kind of very nice and simple ways of thinking about suitability and purposefulness, which makes it very easy to understand, and that is that every time you are moving towards more good qualities inside of you, yeah, that means more kindness, more good-heartedness, more mindfulness, more stillness in the mind, more compassion. All of these good qualities, they are growing. That is when you are fulfilling the purpose and you're doing what is suitable. Yeah? And, or the alternative way of looking at it is that all the bad qualities are going down. Less upset, less anger, less kind of, you know, really coarse desires, less of all of this, less delusion and confusion in the mind. They are going down. And the good ones are going up. Then, you know, you are fulfilling the purpose of the Buddhist path. It's a very simple and easy way to remember, you know, what is suitable and what is right. And that is what clear comprehension knows. It knows whether you're heading in that right direction or whether you are not. And of course, all of that is required. Yeah, you have to have the mindfulness, you have to have the clear comprehension for sense restraint to work out. Otherwise, sense restraint itself becomes impossible. You have to know whether what you're doing is appropriate or not. And, there is a nice, I don't know if there's probably a nice story which you may have heard before, which Ajahn Brahm always tells about the difference between mindfulness and clear comprehension. And the idea of what happens if you just have mindfulness and you don't have a clear comprehension, and you don't have the yonisomanasikara, right? And this is the story, this was I have no idea whether there's any basis in truth or whether it's just completely made up, probably completely made up. But there was this lady, I don't know what Ram talks about, this really wealthy lady, I think in Singapore or something like that, and she had this big house, right? In this house, she had expensive paintings and expensive jewelry and a big safe and all of these kind of things. And then one day she was going to go out. She was living by herself in this house together with all her servants and all these kind of things. And then one day she was going out and, you know, going to the theater, going to have a nice dinner in a restaurant somewhere, and all these kind of things. And then she says to her guardsman, she has a guard at the front door because of all the expensive furniture and all the stuff in the house. So she says to her guard, she says, "Guard, listen, I'm going out for the evening. I want you to be very mindful and very observant of everything because of all these expensive things in my house. I want to kind of feel safe about this. So please be very careful and be very observant." And he said, "Yes, ma'am, I have been through a mindfulness course. I know all about mindfulness." "Yeah, so just you can just relax. Everything will be fine. I will observe everything here." So she goes out, right? And she has a good time. And she comes back. And when she comes back, her front door has been broken down. Her safe has been opened. All the jewelry has disappeared. All the expensive paintings have been torn off the wall. Yeah, and she goes to the guard and she's really angry. "You terrible guard. You said you were going to be observant. You're going to be mindful about everything." And the guard says, "I was mindful of everything. I saw the robbers coming. Robbers coming. Robbers coming. I saw the robbers opening the front door. Robbers opening the front door. Opening the front door. I saw the robbers taking the jewelry. Robbers taking jewelry. Robbers taking jewelry. I saw the robbers driving off. Robbers driving off. Robbers driving off." And right, that is mindfulness. And you are aware of what's going on. But it's a mindfulness without wisdom. Mindfulness where you're not actually doing what you're supposed to be doing here. And this is just to kind of give you a kind of Ajahn Brahm's point of actually making the distinction there between wisdom in the right, mindfulness in the right way, and mindfulness in the wrong way. And this is essentially what we're seeing at this particular point on the path. Okay, so then the next one is, what is then the condition or the nutriment for lack of mindfulness and lack of clear comprehension? And the answer then is careless attention. Yeah, careless attention here is ayoniso manasikara, one of these very fundamental qualities on the Buddhist path. Actually, ayoniso manasikara is not the fundamental. Yoniso manasikara is fundamental. Ayoniso manasikara is what you want to avoid. And what this means, basically, ayoniso manasikara, it means careless attention is roughly right. But one of the translations I like about this is like unwise attention. And yoniso manasikara being the opposite, being wise attention. You are wise about what's going on. You understand what is happening there. Yeah, and this is so fundamental that yoniso manasikara is something that you need from the very beginning when you start out on the Buddhist path and you hear the Buddhist teachings. If you don't have yoniso manasikara and you hear the Buddhist teachings, you think, rubbish, this is rubbish, I'm not interested in this kind of stuff. Morality is for losers, right? I'm not going to be moral. So this is how you think. This is called ayoniso manasikara. And you kind of chuck out all these amazing, wonderful teachings because you are thinking about things in the wrong way here. Yeah, and then all the way along the path, as you practice this path, you know, as you go along, every time you make the right decisions and you do things in the right way, that actually is ayoniso manasikara kicking in and saying, this is the way to do it. You have wise attention about what is going on. And ayoniso manasikara is every time you make a mistake. Yeah, every time anger increases, every time desire increases, every time you break your precepts, every time you do something foolish, which everybody does. You shouldn't feel bad about being foolish sometimes. Everybody is foolish sometimes. It's okay. We just learn to forgive ourselves and move on. This is what it refers to. It's a very foundational part of the Buddhist path. How can it be defined more clearly? Maybe often people think that they know what wise attention means. Yeah, you have a rough idea. Okay, now I'm being wise. Now I'm being unwise. But sometimes we get it wrong. Sometimes we think we are wise when we're actually not wise. Sometimes we think we have an insight in meditation, but actually, perhaps it isn't really an insight. Perhaps it's something else going on. It's very hard to say. That's why the question that we had the other day, was that here we had that question? I'm getting confused now because there was a question about how do you recognize real insight? I think somebody asked that a couple of days ago, yeah? And it's a very good question. And the answer is that you know it because you feel more peaceful afterwards, because you let go of things. That is how you know that something is a real insight. And this is the idea, when you have a real insight, that is equivalent to yoniso manasikara. You see things, you use wise attention. Yeah, so every time, if you have wise attention on something, the way that you know that something is wise attention, is again, exactly what I was saying before, this idea that the good qualities in the mind go up, and the bad qualities go down. If you have ayoniso manasikara, it's exactly the opposite. Then the bad qualities go up, the good qualities go down. So that is as simple as that, and that is how you know the distinction between those two things. So it is very useful as a definition, because it's so easy to kind of fool ourselves to think, yeah, I'm being wise, but actually you need some kind of neutral, clear definition to understand, to really be sure about that, and that is what that gives you. So when you have yoniso manasikara, when you have wise attention, it means that you understand those things that are worthy of your attention and how you attend to these things. So because of that, it supports the idea of sampajanya, clear comprehension, full awareness. Yeah, all of these things revolve around each other, things that we're talking about now. Ayoniso manasikara, clear comprehension, sampajanya, and sense restraint. these things are very closely related to each other. Sati, mindfulness as well, is very much part of this. And I'll give you an example of how this works, right? Because an example is always very very handy. The way it works, now, if you are, you know, in your ordinary life, whatever it is, and you come across all kind of things, some of these things make you kind of upset, some of them make you attached, some of them make you kind of more at peace and at ease with things. So if you, the first thing that you need to be able to know where your mind is going is mindfulness, yeah? You need some degree of mindfulness to know what is happening inside of you. Then, as you go about your daily activities, you have a degree of mindfulness, then sampajanya, the full awareness, will tell you whether what is happening right now is appropriate, whether it's suitable or not. So you are mindful and you can see that you are in contact with somebody or something that is about to make you upset. Yeah, so sampajanya tells you, oh, danger, this is not going to be supportive for the practice of the path. This is not suitable for where I actually want to go with my life. That's what sampajanya does. And then once you understand that you are about to head in the wrong direction, you're seeing the negative qualities in somebody, and that is about to make you upset because you see that, then yonisomanasikara kicks in and asks and tells you a different way of looking at that person so it doesn't lead to upset after all. Yeah, you are aware, you understand you are on the wrong track, and then you change your attitude. That is kind of the sequence here. And this is how you regulate your mind on the kind of daily basis or on a meditation or whatever it is. How you regulate it and make sure that it stays stable throughout the day. It isn't kind of kicked around by the ups and downs of things so much. Yeah, so you're mindful. Mindfulness tells you whether what you're doing is suitable and appropriate. If it is not suitable and appropriate, then yonisomanasikara tells you how to change it. How to change your perception so as to make it suitable. Yeah, this is how it works. So that's the wisdom faculty that comes in last there. And I'm going to, again, talk about this in much more detail later on, because this is a kind of, these are all very crucial aspects of the path. So then the question is, what is the nutriment for careless attention? And it says here, the lack of faith, right? Lack of faith is a nutriment for ayoniso manasikara. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Lack of faith is a nutriment for seeing things in the wrong way. And this again shows you, as I was saying yesterday, the very strong connection in Buddhism between faith and confidence on the one hand and wisdom on the other hand. Yeah, these things are very closely related to each other in the Buddhist teachings. If you have a degree of confidence and faith in the Buddhist teachings, where does that faith and confidence come from? Well, it comes from a degree of wisdom in the first place. You have to have a degree of wisdom to have that confidence in these teachings. And then that confidence in those teachings means that you apply them in a certain way. And that application is then the wise application of those teachings, which is the yonisomanasikara. So they revolve around each other. You know, when you become more wise, you have more confidence and faith. And as the confidence and faith increases, you have more wisdom. The two kind of work together in Buddhism, which is very different from how faith is considered in many other teachings, many other religions. It's quite unique to Buddhism. These things are so closely related to each other. And this is one of the reasons why I often prefer the translation faith instead of the translation confidence instead of faith. The Pali word is sadda, and because faith to me has much more of the kind of the traditional religious kind of Western religious Christian kind of ideas of faith, whereas confidence is more about has more of this sense of wisdom aspect to it. You are confident because it makes sense, because it all hangs together, because it isn't irrational. Yeah. So confidence is also is a nice way of thinking about sadha. The problem with the word confidence is that it doesn't really give you an idea that there is an emotional aspect to this. The sadha in Pali is not just about kind of intellectual consent or intellectual assent to what is going on, to say, yeah, this makes sense or whatever, in a kind of dry intellectual way. that is part of metta, but a very important part of sadha in Pali is the emotional content. Yeah, you feel, wow, this is amazing, this is astonishing, you feel really inspired by these teachings. You think about the Buddha and you think, it's just absolutely unbelievable that I've been able to find this kind of the spiritual teacher who was so wise. I have found this teacher and now I can practice accordingly. What an astonishing thing. And you feel so inspired by that and you feel kind of uplifted by that. And this then, if you do this in the right way, this becomes a force in your meditation practice. This becomes that basic pamuja and piti on the path that allows the meditation to work later on. So sadha in Buddhism has both of these qualities, and so neither faith nor confidence, I think, gives full gives the full force of what that word actually means. So you can kind of imagine almost like a combination of faith and confidence is really what the word sadha is all about. And then you get the right idea. And inspiration is a nice way of thinking about it. Because inspiration in English means, well, it means, first of all, it is an emotional thing. That's the same thing in German, presumably. Inspiration or something like that, I assume. I don't know, but I assume. So you have this inspiration, which means a certain degree of knowledge. Yeah, you are inspired by some teaching. And it also has an emotional aspect when you are inspired. It lifts you up. You feel positive about something. This is the faith on this path. So the faith and confidence is very important. And when you have that confidence, you apply the mind in the right way. And that is what Yoniso Manasikara is all about here. So what is the cause and the nutriment for faith or confidence? And what it says here is hearing the good Dhamma. Yeah, Saddhamma Savananga is the Pali phrase. The hearing the good Dhamma. Saddhamma. Dhamma just means teaching. So the good Dhamma, that means the real teaching. The teaching which is, of course, the Buddhist Dhamma, and etc., etc. So you have to hear the good teachings. And when you hear those good teachings, you think, yeah, wow, cool, I gotta do this. This is really good stuff. That's what you feel when you hear the right teachings. And it's interesting when you hear, it's not just about hearing the right teachings, of course. It is also about seeing the person who gives those teachings. Yeah, sometimes if you can imagine seeing the Buddha and you see this supremely calm person who just, you know, exudes kind of compassion and confidence, but in a kind of subtle confidence in a very subtle way, right? Not kind of a sort of egotistical confidence, but a more kind of subtle kind of confidence. And he has all those qualities, and then you see the qualities, and the teachings match with the qualities match with the teachings. It is that kind of combination that is really, really powerful. And this is why you will see in the suttas, and this is again quite unique to Buddhism, I think, where the Buddha says, well, investigate me here. Look at me. Do you see any defiled qualities in me here? Do you see any greed? Do you see any anger? Do you see any confusion and delusion? Investigate. So the Buddha is challenging us to actually look for these qualities. And this is one of the things that we should do. Of course, what this means is that we should do the same thing in the present day. Who are the teachers really worth listening to in the world? And they are, of course, precisely those teachers that have realized some of these teachings. So you watch them, you observe them to some extent, and to see whether they have those qualities that they're supposed to have or not. Yeah, it's exactly the same idea. And then when you hear the teachings combined with seeing the living example, whoa, it becomes very, very powerful. That's what I have found in my life. Sometimes you meet teachers that are really exceptional, very, very inspiring. I've met a few of those. And for me, one of those, of course, is Ajahn Brahm. I find him very kind of inspirational in so many ways. And when you have that, you see the living example on the one hand, and on the other hand, you have the ancient suttas of the Buddha that expound this precise doctrine that leads to this example in front of you. Then that becomes a very powerful combination. If you just have the suttas, it becomes kind of dry. Okay, there's all this ink on paper, yeah, but I mean, it's not really sure about it, because it sounds good, but it's very hard to know whether it really works. And then just having the living example can also be dangerous, because it isn't anchored in anything. It becomes like some kind of, you know, wild individual, kind of charismatic teacher who kind of with a may kind of look great, but because it isn't anchored in anything, often it becomes too much about that person rather than about a tradition or whatever. And that's where often you get kind of guruism, and you get sects and all kind of problems arising because of that. When the two come together, it's very powerful. And one of the reasons why it's powerful is because we all, in the end, take the Buddha as our teacher. So there's not too much focus on individual teachers in Buddhism. Yeah, this is, I think, one of those very important things that is often underestimated, is the idea that we should ultimately take the Buddha as our teacher, and not individuals within the tradition. So if we take individuals as our teacher, it ends up too much like a worship of gurus and worship of individuals. And we lose this beautiful thing whereby we're all not exactly on the same level, perhaps, but we are more equal in a sense as all disciples of the Buddha, rather than having a massive hierarchy within Buddhism itself. So watch out for that. There's too much guru worship in the Buddhist world. Yeah, there's too many teachers who set themselves up and say, "Ah, don't worry about the sutta, just leave those aside. Yeah, you can't really rely on that, but you can rely on me, right? That's kind of the implication there. So listen to me, because I know what's going on." They don't actually say that, because to say that would be too much. But that's kind of the feeling you get sometimes. Straight away, I feel a little bit dodgy about that. And this is one of the things I also liked about Ajahn Brahm. He says it quite straight out, Buddha should be your final teacher. That's where you should be. And I find that very reassuring when somebody says that. And I find that very... Yeah, this is kind of one of those, again, very Buddhist things that we take something outside of us as a final refuge and final reference for what are the real teachings. Okay, anyway, so you hear all of these things and you hear the Dhamma and you think, yay, I hear Dhamma, whoa! You get faith and confidence and you practice forward as a consequence of that. So what is the nutriment for hearing the good Dhamma? And it is associating with good persons. Sapurisa, sangseva. Sapurisa means like superior people, good people, true people, if you like. The idea, of course, behind that is precisely the Aryans, the noble ones. These are these people, because they have understood these teachings. They know what they are about. So when you associate with them, when you hang out with the Aryans, then of course you get the benefit of hearing the real Dhamma. And that is where faith arises in real spiritual teachings as a consequence. Yeah, so you hang out with the Saparisa. So how do you hang out with the Saparisa? Yeah, that's an interesting question. How do you know? Who are these people that you're supposed to hang out with? Okay, well, the answer is, Saparisa number one is the Buddha. Yeah, how do you hang out with the Buddha? You read the sutta. That's how you hang out with the Buddha. Yeah, that's what we're doing now. We're hanging out with the Buddha. What does it feel like? It's pretty good, right? Hopefully, maybe I'm not sure what you feel about it, but I feel quite good about it. So this is how you do that. This is how you hang out with the Buddha. You kind of just read the suttas, and then you are associating with the Saparisa at that very time. And this is a very useful perception to have when you read the suttas, to have the perception that the Buddha is actually talking to you when you do this. So how is it? How can you have that perception that the Buddha is talking to you? And the way to have that perception, one of the ways that I really like to think about the Buddha, is that when the Buddha started teaching 2,500 years ago, what he said is that he set in motion the wheel of the Dhamma, right? We had a look at the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta yesterday or the day before, whenever it was. And he knows that he's setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. So what he is aware of, he's aware that this teaching here is going to keep on rolling out in the world, down the generation, from one generation to the next one, from one epoch to the next epoch, from one culture to another culture. Yeah, going on from moving on down the centuries and down the millennia. The Buddha is aware of that when he actually gives his teachings. Yeah, that is the only conclusion that you can come to when he says that he set in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. And because he is aware of that, he phrases the Dhamma in such a way that it is basically universally applicable. It doesn't relate to one particular culture. it doesn't relate to one particular time period. It relates to beings. It relates to humanity. It relates to anyone who is in this predicament, which basically is all beings. Yeah. So this is why what I find is so astonishing about the suttas, when you read them, you get this feeling that they are, it's almost like, not quite, but almost in a modern kind of language. You can relate to these things very easily. If you read some kind of other ancient literature from that time period, it's complete gobbledygook, right? You can't understand anything what's going on. It's really weird. Like, for example, the Brahmanical suttas, what is known as the Upanishads, for example. If you try to read that, it's like you're entering into this world of magic and weirdness that makes absolutely no sense to you. And you feel that it is very tightly woven into Indian culture of that time. And you can't really extract it from that Indian culture. Whereas the suttas, they have this beautiful universal applicability to them. And this is because, I think, in very large part, because, well, first of all, because the Buddha was he didn't really deal in magic so much. He dealt more in natural phenomena. But secondly, he phrased it in such a way that it would be applicable down the centuries and down the millennia. So in a very real sense, right, the Buddha was thinking of us when he was giving these teachings. Yeah, he knew that there were people coming together here in this Buddha center 2,500 years down the line. They would be sitting in this room, right? And they would be listening to these teachings. So, not precisely that, right? But roughly that. And because of that, when you read these teachings, it is not only as if the Buddha is speaking directly to you. In a very real sense, it is speaking directly to you. Yeah, he knew about this. He knew how these things would unfold into the future. So he was talking to you directly when you read these suttas. So when you remember that, then these suttas take on a very different feeling, rather than being some ancient historical document that was spoken in India 2,500 years ago. They become relevant in a very, very different sense. And somewhere else the Buddha says, what does it say? That the Dhamma is for those who feel, right? So if you have any feelings whatsoever, it means the Dhamma is for you. If you have no feelings, then maybe you are in the wrong place anyway. this is kind of the right way, I find a very suitable way of thinking about the Buddha, because it makes the Dhamma so alive and so powerful when you think about it in this way. The Buddha is talking to you right here, right now. And that is what you see with this. So this is the idea of the Satbodhisa and the Buddha talking to you. Of course, it's not just the Buddha. There are, I think, also it's fair to say that there are other people in this world as well who are noble ones who have seen these teachings for themselves. Very often it's just a map. It's very hard to pin it down very often who these people are. But sometimes you get a feeling, and sometimes you, especially if what they say matches what the Buddha said, you can be fairly confident that, not confident perhaps, but at least you can listen to those teachings and add that to your understanding of the suttas. Especially if those people expound the suttas, that's also very nice, because you get this, all of these things kind of coming together in this way. So that is the Buddha and the Satbodhisa, the importance of these things. And one of the interesting things, of course, is why is it? Why is this so important? Why is this? What we have come to now remember is the very foundation of this whole path. Yeah, we have looked how delusion is at the top, and delusion is the problem we want to deal with. And now we have found the root cause of that delusion. And the root cause is not associating with these superior people, not hearing the good Dhamma. That is the root cause. Yeah, there's nothing really prior to that. This is the kind of the first point on this path. So what that means, of course, is what we have to do to overcome delusion ultimately is to keep on listening to the Dhamma, keep on reading the suttas, keep on investigating them, keep on understanding them. And as we do that, this whole path unfolds naturally, because one thing is a nutriment for the next one. It builds up the next factor, which then builds up the next factor, and the whole thing kind of builds up till you end up with the ending of delusion. That's all you have to do, right? That's what it says here. All you have to do is to read the suttas. Yeah, so it's so easy to practice this path. You just bring out the suttas, you take these four books, yeah, you go on and you start reading. And before you know it, bang, delusion is gone. Yeah, that's what he's saying. Yeah. Whoa, if I only knew the path was so easy, I'd become a Buddhist a long time ago. This is kind of this is really the essence. So remember that. If you ever have any doubt about where you should focus your efforts or what you should do, you feel a bit kind of uncertain about things, go back to those teachings. Play some kind of inspiring talk with someone who explains Buddhism in a good way. Read a little bit in the sutta. Inspire yourself and move forward on this path. And as you do that, the whole thing kind of starts to happen all by itself. Yeah, isn't that kind of nice? I think it's so beautiful when you think about that way. This is how it all comes together in this way. So the question then is, why is it? I want to talk a little bit about why that is the case. Why is it that just hanging out with the noble people can have this very powerful effect? Because once you understand the whys, it is much easier to accept that this may actually be true. Because it may sound like I'm exaggerating, yeah. But actually, if you look at the sutta, that's pretty much what it says. It doesn't look like I'm exaggerating that much. But how can this be true? How can this possibly be the case? And the answer is to understand what we are as human beings, what we are as any kind of being for that matter. And of course, to understand that, you have to go back to the basic idea, Buddhist idea of non-self. Yeah, non-self just means that there is no core inside of us, no kind of entity inside of us that is always stable. If you have a stable entity inside of yourself, then maybe you could walk down a certain path and stay that path, because that stable entity inside of you would tell you what is the right direction. But if there is no entity, if there is no stability, if there is no essence, if there is no core inside of you, then what are we? Well, what we are the sum of all the causality, all the conditions, all the influences that work on us. Yeah, that's what we are. Because there is no essence inside of you, it means that all the conditions that work on you, this is what makes you the person who you are right now. And those causes and conditions, they come from outside. They also come from inside of yourself. They come from the present moment, but they also come from deep into the past. And if you have an idea of past lives and these kind of things, a lot of the causality, a lot of the conditions that work on us, they also come from past lives. The more you understand this, the more you understand that who you are now is the sum total of all those causes and conditions working on you, the more you can appreciate why it is so important to have the superior people to teach you Dhamma in the first place. And one way of looking at this, I always use the same kind of simile because I think it works, at least it works very well for me. If you imagine you have a ship on the ocean, and the ship on the ocean, it has no steering mechanism. There is no rudder, there is no engine, there is no propeller, there are no oars, there is no paddle, right? There is nothing you can use to steer this ship. It's just like the hull of a ship sitting on the ocean, black on the bang on the ocean like that. Now, where is that ship going to go? If it has no steering mechanism, well, where it's going to go is according to the causes and conditions outside of itself. So if the wind comes from the south, the ship is going to go to the north. If the current comes from the east, the ship is going to go to the west. All of these external conditions are going to decide which way the ship is going. Yeah, so if the ship wants to go to country A, how is that ship going to go to country A if it is completely dependent on external causes? It can't depend on itself, right, because there's nothing to steer it. So what you have to do is you have to place that ship in a current, in the wind, in such a place whereby that wind will drive it towards country A. And then it will reach country A. Yeah, that is the only way. There is no other way that will happen. In exactly the same way, we, if you want to move towards Nirvana, if you want to move to the end of all suffering and to the highest happiness, sounds good, right? I'm very surprised if anyone doesn't want that, but if you don't want that, then, of course, then we'll talk about it later on. if that's what we want, and I think everybody naturally wants something like that anyway, then of course what you have to do is you have to put yourself into those causes and conditions that drive you in that direction, that move you towards nirvana, move you towards the highest happiness. What are those causes and conditions? Well, they are precisely the Buddha's teaching. Yeah, because he has seen what is going on. He knows the path there. And he will then influence you. He will condition you in such a way that you also will move towards nirvana. That's the only way you will get there, if you put yourself into that current, into that wind which drives you in the right direction. There is no other way. This is why the Saparisa is so fundamental on the Buddhist path, and why it is so absolutely important. Without it, you cannot go there. And this is why in the very famous sutta, the Buddha, there's a very famous discussion between the Buddha and Venerable Ananda, and where Venerable Ananda says to the Buddha, Kalyanamitta. Kalyanamitta is good friendship, right? Kalyanamitta is very similar to the idea of Saparisa. A real good friend is the Buddha, first and foremost. And then, of course, you have other good friends, the other Aryans. And then you have all your friends, right, who come together with you on your retreat and practice together with you. All of these things, they count as well. Everyone who moves you in the right direction is a Kalyanamitta on the path. But number one Kalyanamitta is, of course, the Buddha. Venerable Ananda says to the Buddha, Master, I understand. Kalyanamitta is 50% of the holy life. It is half of the holy life. Yeah, in other words, it's really important, right? 50%, it means incredibly important. And of course, for those of you who know the suttas, you will know what the Buddha replies. The Buddha says, not so, Ananda, not so. Kalyanamitta is 100% of the holy life. It is everything. Why? Because without that Kalyanamitta, you're not going to get to Nirvana. You're not going to move forward on the Buddhist path. It is only through someone who has had those insights that you will be able to move in the same direction. It's 100% of the holy life. And now you can sort of see why that is the case. Yeah? Because without that, this whole process doesn't even start. I remember when I first read that saying in the suttas, you know, it's 100% of the whole life. I said, sure, it's 100%. It's an exaggeration. The Buddha is exaggerating. Yeah, what about all the other stuff, sila and all the kind of things? But the Buddha doesn't usually exaggerate. The Buddha, if anything, he is kind of understated usually, very understated. He says things in a very simple way, but usually have very profound meaning. And after a while, I started to realize that the Buddha doesn't exaggerate. Yeah. And then it took me a long time though to actually understand what is going on there. And that is the meaning behind that. Without that initial impetus, that initial push from the wind coming from the right direction, the Dhamma coming from the right direction, there is no way you're going to go anywhere. And this is why this is so important and why this is the very foundation and the very basis for actually attaining Nirvana in this life. So keep on coming back to these things. Yeah, this is really what this is all about. This is what it means. So keep on, if you keep on coming back to these things, if you keep on getting brainwashed by the Buddha's teachings, right? This is the idea of brainwashing again. And usually people say, I don't want to be brainwashed. I want to be independent, right? I want to kind of make my own decisions. No, you have to be brainwashed. Yeah, this is the only way. Because the point is that regardless of the case, we get brainwashed. Whether it is brain, you can choose. The only thing you can do is choose your brainwashing. Yeah? So choose, for goodness sake, the right brainwashing. Yeah? Because everything is conditioning. And when everything is conditioning, it means that you're going to be brainwashed regardless. So get the right washing powder. The right washing powder is this. This is the right washing powder. Yeah? This is there. And then get the right washing machine. Get a nice German washing machine. And then you are in business as a consequence. This is what that means. So we're going to continue, stop the brainwashing there, and we're going to continue the brainwashing this afternoon. So we'll see you again at 3 o'clock. In the meantime, keep on enjoying yourself.